Ladies and gentlemen, this is the 12th and final round.
Right hand, Golovkin steps in and down he goes again.
Unbelievable.
Mayweather makes him pay. What a rookie mistake.
A sensational left hook by De La Hoya.
It's facts. I'm the best. You know what I mean? Sometimes I don't want to believe it myself, but it's the truth. I'm the best.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
From Southern California, this is the Last Round Podcast.
Welcome back to this week's episode of the Last Round Podcast. We were out last week, so we apologize for no episode last week, but we are back. Actually, I'm back solo. Mike is out this week. Yeah, he should be back next week, but subbing in for him as a recurring guest who's been on the show multiple times. I still call him a new resident of the United States. He's still in that honeymoon phase here in the United States, over here on the West Coast. Formerly of the Insider, but he now has new outlets that he's working for after leaving the Insider within the last few months or so. Journalist and reporter Alan Dawson joins us again. Thank you for joining us, Al.
Oh, thanks for having me, Danny. And now that Mike's not here, we can badmouth him a little bit.
Oh yeah, I'm going to send it to him right after. He's going to be the first guy who listens to all of this. So as I just touched on, Al, you came over here from the UK on behalf of the Insider. You moved to Las Vegas, working for the Insider. You were there for a while. When did you actually, I know we touched on it before, but for somebody who's listening for the first time today, who hasn't heard you before, when did you actually, when was your first day in the United States?
January 31st, 2022. So it's pretty much 18 months that I've been in America and I haven't left yet. I've been here the whole time. Yeah, it's been pretty sweet. 2022 felt like a real MMA town for Vegas. Like UFC is just so dominant here. And I kind of wasn't, I knew how big they were, but I wasn't expecting them to dominate the combat sports scene so much. But it really feels like this year is just all boxing. And like, I know we're going to get into some review stuff, but the events that I've seen this year from, you know, March all the way through to last weekend, I'm just completely blown away by one, performance level of certain athletes, like Herculean efforts, and two, just the magnitude of the events that are being put together and the momentum boxing has. I feel like it's really starting to restore its spot as the number one combat sport. I know this is a boxing show and people won't like to hear that, but I feel like UFC is really really did overtake boxing. You know, at the start of the pandemic, UFC came out the gate so quickly to put on shows behind the scenes, and their shows were big. You know, just in the very first show back in front of an empty arena, Justin Gaethje put on a clinic against Tony Ferguson. That was like a fight of the year nominee. And boxing was just so slow to come out the gate. And we were putting on small hall shows, you know, like of that caliber fights. And I feel like that kind of led into last year quite a lot as well. I don't think we really had one, what I would call, you know, mega event. But this year, it's just like, you know, every single month we've got something huge. And yeah, I don't think the UFC has, because, you know, Conor McGregor's will he, won't he come back? And, you know, Francis Ngannou left and feel like, you know, we should have had John Jones and Ngannou. But yeah, the big fight's happening in boxing now, and it's amazing to be a part of the business, you know, as a reporter on the media side, especially in Las Vegas, because it just feels a lot of the stuff has been going on here.
Absolutely. And, you know, as we touched on multiple times in the last few minutes, you were with the Insider up until recently. So for everybody listening right now who's wondering, like, hey, you know, Al, what happened? You know, you're with the Insider. They moved you over here to the United States. Now you're not. Now you're with these other outlets, which we'll elaborate in a second. You know, just explain to me and to the listeners, you know, how you got to where you're at as of today.
Yeah, I mean, even I was at Insider for like 7 years, and five of those years were in the UK newsroom. I was the first sports hire in the UK newsroom, and I was covering soccer, tennis, boxing and MMA, and the combat sports side just got so big that I said, you know, we need to bring in other people to do the sports that I like, but I just want to focus on fights. So we grew, and we had a team of like maybe at one point maybe 10 people, and that Insider was growing rapidly as well. I think at one point there was probably 1,200 employees with bureaus all over the world. And I don't think during my time there in 7 years, there'd been one round of layoffs. And then there was a round of layoffs in April. And pretty much the entire sports team was a part of that, and so was I. And I don't hold any ill will towards, you know, I think you've just got to accept it. If you're in media, you're going to get laid off, you know, every now and then. I think that's only my second layoff. It's actually my third. I've done, that's happened to me quite a few times. But the first,
hopefully, it's the last time.
Yeah. Although I'm not going to like count it out. But now I'm independent, so it's like I'm going to be my own boss. But yeah, the first time it happened was at Goal.com, and that was like the world's biggest soccer website. I was laid off there in 2011. Where else was I laid off? A company that I'm not going to mention because it was like I was kind of like in between phase and it wasn't really something I'm putting on my resume. And then I was at BT Sport. That helped me get the job at Insider. And to be fair, like in those 7 years I was there, it really was the making of me as a reporter and journalist. The sort of stories they were covering and politics and tech and all these other beats, digital culture, YouTube, exposing like, you know, sex scandals, harassment, you know, political corruption. It really made me think, you know, why aren't I doing that on boxing? I should be if I'm working at this company that's doing all these other things. So that's one of the reasons I got into, you know, trying to like scrutinize the involvement of, you know, people like Daniel Kinahan in the sport. And last year, I think it was last year, I wrote about this court case that was basically making it seem that there were suspicions or allegations of bribery and corruption in American boxing between like basically buying rankings from the WBA. So that's still in a court case. And all those sort of stuff's won the Boxing Writers Awards. So yeah, I had a really good run at Insider. Definitely was the making of me, really reshaped me quite a lot that I'm realizing now, because I'm, you know, coming back into like the boxing side, and it's making me realize how corporatized I probably was, you know, Insider, Business Insider. And I can, you know, probably re-find who I was before maybe and, you know, figure out my identity as a media person going forward. So I was told on these that I was a part of these layoffs in April. I was a member of the union though, so I couldn't actually be laid off there and then because the union was bargaining, you know, for severance and things like that. So my last official day was June 5th. Before that, though, I'd already like hooked up with a talent agent. It's called Eric Winter. So he used to work.
He was. I think he worked for UFC.
Yeah.
Is that him? And then he was also guy. With, I think, Top Rank for Top a little rank. Bit.
Yeah, correct. Right. So he's been helping, like, giving me business advice and really, really good ear to, you know, bend. He's been around combat sports for a long time, particularly in America. I'd got job offers already. So like I just contacted a few people, barely sent my resume out. I was really, really fortunate. I think the difference between being laid off now and being laid off, when would it have been 11 years ago for the first time, is that it took me so long to get back into sports media. But this time I feel like maybe my name's already out there a little bit more than what I realized. And that I've now been able to sign deals with ProBox TV. I'm their news editor, Fight Hype videographer for boxing and MMA, but they want me to be the face of their MMA coverage. I'm going to do a weekly column with the Sporting Tribune for boxing and MMA. The first one's coming out tomorrow, I hope. And I'm going to do some feature writing for Premier Boxing Champions. I'm also speaking to one more client. But yeah, the whole point is to set up this business now and kind of funnel all this through, you know, regular ongoing work with certain companies, trying to follow the kind of Ariel Helwani route rather than being so reliant on one employer.
Are you thinking about, you know, you touched on going the Ariel Helwani route. You know, he has his MMA hour and it's very popular and, you know, he gets pretty big guests and stuff. And now that you're independent, would you think about jumping into the podcast game or kind of getting your own show, or what do you think?
I mean, yeah, there's things that I think I'd like to do that on Fight Hype, though. There's definitely ideas I want to do on Fight Hype. Like, I don't want to do kind of like this traditional YouTube media. I've got like kind of ideas of how, you know, I'd want to do it more like local news, how they do it. So you've got somebody outside a building with a microphone and you're kind of talking like a news anchor or presenter. So I kind of want to like approach it like that. I have set up like YouTube and Rumble and Substack accounts in like Alan Dawson Sport, like standard handles that I've got on other social media, just to park them. But yeah, I'm still thinking of like using, you know, my writing skills to branch out in maybe other areas of boxing media. because of, yeah, the contacts you make. As soon as I moved into America, the contacts I made were just like, I don't know, I felt like I was making far more inroads over here than I ever did in Britain.
Mm-hmm. So who, you are independent, as you mentioned. So is there one or the other where you're going to be spending more of your time in terms of the outlets that you mentioned?
Pro Box TV will definitely take up a bit of my time. But the thing is, a lot of the work's kind of like, you know, I'm kind of doing this with my hands, but it's like kind of feeds into one another. Like if I'm doing an interview with, say, I don't know, like Leonard Ellerbe, he's here in Las Vegas, you know, I could write about it, send some news to Pro Box. The video, like on different parts of the video can go out on Fight Hype. You know, all these kind of things go, you know, you get paid twice for the same or, you know, similar piece of work. And just figuring out where that kind of content goes, you know, Eric Nixick, MMA coach that's based here, you know, that could easily go out on two, you know, clients, one written and one, you know, I could write a column on, you know, how he's going to coach Sean Strickland for the upcoming Israel Adesanya title fight, or how he thinks Francis Ngannou could fare against Tyson Fury, because he works with both those fighters, Ngannou and Strickland. You know, could do a column on that, and then again send the video to Fight Hype. So I feel like I'm probably at the moment the clients are kind of skewed more towards boxing than they are in MMA. But I'm working on that, so I'm trying to get another client in MMA or both as well. But I feel like after one more, I think that'll probably be my schedule done for the rest of the year. But yeah, really pleased with how it's worked out. Could have easily been quite stressful to, you know, not only lose your job, but then, you know, be a deportation risk. you know, and we've bought a house here, you know, literally about like 6 weeks, I think, before I got told I was being laid off.
Oh, wow.
But I feel like looking back, it's like I'd much rather have bought the house then than like now, because I don't know, it seems like, you know, now we're here, we're already paying the mortgage. And
yeah,
but like, you know, it could have easily been stressful, and it didn't, and it wasn't too bad in the end.
In those 18 months, Al, that you were here in the United States and Las Vegas, obviously, primarily for The Insider, what's the one moment that you'll remember from those 18 months, that first 18 month ride?
When I was like, there were a couple of stories that I wrote at the back end of last year, and it just seemed like all of a sudden the big fights were happening, or that there was significant talks to, like, you know, I was kind of getting the sort of background on why the Spence Crawford negotiations fell apart. But then like a week before, maybe not a week before, I think I'm getting the timing wrong. I think I first reported on Spence Crawford like in July. And then like a month later, I found out that, you know, the Davis and Garcia's camp were talking. And just to see, go from there to then seeing those fights happen now, you know, with Davis Garcia in, where did that happen? I think April 22nd. And then Spence Crawford finally come together and having that on July 29th and just being able to be in the venue for those two shows. Benavidez plan as well. I love that. I feel like that kicked off everything as well. That was such a high quality event, you know, that wasn't just, usually boxing is just so top heavy for the main event, but it felt like that show was just a, you know, big celebration of, you know, Mexican-American fighters. I know Ramos was on the undercard looking good as well. And I feel like PBC is really getting, like, I don't think maybe this, people haven't noticed this, but PBC is really putting Ramos on a really high platform.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
Yeah, it's like he's always on the main card for these massive pay-per-view shows. And I feel like they're actually telling us something, like this guy's going to be a pay-per-view headliner.
Yeah, you know, keep
on getting used to this guy, paying for this guy, you know, rather than him being on, say, you know, the normal Showtime Championship Boxing. He's a Showtime pay-per-view fighter now. Yeah, so see, I feel like that Benavidez plan event, that really kicked everything off. And then, you know, a month later, Davis Garcia, Haney Lomachenko was the next month. Yeah, Spence Crawford. And then we've got, you know, Canelo Charlo next month. I feel like we're probably going to get another reasonably big boxing show here before the end of the year as well. And yeah, I've even heard rumors that, you know, the Raiders owner Mark Davis, he's apparently, like, I wouldn't say desperate, but he's really, really eager to bring a boxing fight into you know, the Allegiant Stadium. And it just depends what fight that is. I think it would be great, but I personally think that people should focus on, and I've even said this to a few, like, I don't want to tell people how to do their jobs, but I can't help but say, you should do this, you know, put a fight at the Sphere. Have you seen the Sphere?
Yeah, it looks awesome.
That, because it's a one tier. It's all just one tier. So it's not an arena that, you know, with the seats going all the way around the ring. The ring right. would be on stage like a concert hall, and then there'd be 15,000 seats, you know, like a, you know, the atmosphere that you could have for that. It'd be like an old school Coliseum or something. And it's, I don't want to exaggerate, but I'm sure it's like 1,000 times bigger than a cinema screen, because all of the screens are like in front of you, behind you, right above you. The sound systems are, you know, just as advanced, but the screens are also on the exterior of the Sphere. So I was thinking you could broadcast a part of it to the parking lot that they've got there and have like sell tickets as a drive through. So you could do like $1,000 average ticket on the inside for a massive event at the Sphere. And then charge like, you know, $100 for a car coming in with like 5 people in an SUV or something. Self, you know, have pop-up food trucks. And you could do what the F1 is threatening here, where they're going to like put up, you know, obstructions if, you know, various casinos aren't going to pay them $2.5 million. You could do that to prevent people from seeing it who aren't paying. But yeah, the only thing I find jarring about hot boxing in Las Vegas is at the moment is you're putting the events on at the T-Mobile Arena. And right when you walk into the T-Mobile Arena, there's this massive sign with UFC fighters saying this is the home of the UFC.
Yeah.
So it's like you're putting boxing's biggest events in the MMA market leader's home. To me, it's the home of the Golden Knights, really. But the UFC does have 3 or 4 big pay-per-view shows there a year. And they've just got the sort of marketing and the branding already in the arena. There's like UFC, the acronym is like on one of the in the middle tier. So you can see it wherever you are. The good thing about MGM Grand Garden Arena when boxing was there is it just felt there was so much history in that venue for boxing. And it feels like the UFC is already kind of cornering the history for T-Mobile Arena a little bit. That's how I feel. So that's why I think boxing should kind of pivot and go to the Sphere and, yeah, maybe have a big one at the Allegiant. I can't remember what you asked now, but I've gone. I got complete tangent. Tangent.
Well, you touched on the F1 going to Vegas, and obviously that's a big deal. And then there's like, you know, politics happening in the city about, you know, blocking the views if they don't pay a premium, these hotels and all that. So they're trying to sort through all that. But that, I'm not sure how long the F1 it lasts. Do you know how long it's going to last during that time?
I think the chaos would be a while, but I think it will be, I mean, I think it'll be a whole week thing, but there's already going to be events like on the periphery from other sports, right. You know, Shakur Stevenson is going to be fighting on the Saturday,
right.
Las Vegas, against a like to be determined opponent. And I'm
Do you think any other promoter is going to try to capitalize on that event, like that whole week event? Because, you know, there's going to be a lot of, you know, high profile people and a lot of people with a lot of money, around that city.
I think Top Rank's kind of already cornered it in a boxing sense. I'm not sure if the UFC will try and, you know, maybe they will, because Dana White obviously has got like this rivalry and animosity towards Bob Arum. But yeah, I feel like for boxing, Top Rank's kind of already cornered that. I can't imagine them putting Shakur Stevenson in Virgin Hotels or Resorts World, which where Top Rank has used those two facilities for like events that might sell, you know, 2,000-3,000 tickets. Shakur's way too big for those arenas. It would have to be MGM Grand again at the very minimum. And then, you know, what else is there? Is it T-Mobile maybe for the UFC? But yeah, this seems like there's going to be quite a lot of activations around that week. So if you're coming to Vegas, get prepared. Yeah. You know, one, to pay stupid prices. I saw one earlier to stay in a hotel from like the Thursday until, you know, check out on the Sunday. And it was $1,000 a night, and it wasn't even a premium, you know, resort. So it was three times the price of what they normally sell. But yeah, some packages I've seen have been $2.5 million for a 10-person. You know, like you get your suite for the the 3 or 4 days. You get VIP access to all of the stuff from the Thursday. I think it's Thursday practice, Friday practice, Saturday qualifying, Sunday race. Which seems like a lot, but if there's 10 of you, it's $250,000 each. I'm trying to think, you know, is that decent? But you know, maybe they get other perks as well. I imagine they do.
Yeah, you would think, right? For that amount of money, you would hope so. You would hope so. Well, obviously, you know, Mike and I are glad that you kind of landed on your feet. Like you said, it was a little bit of a nerve-wracking time for you during those layoffs at Insider and stuff. But like you said, realistically, especially in sports media, there's always layoffs at one point or another. So it's unfortunate, but you know, we're glad you landed back on your feet.
I appreciate you.
And staying in the fight game here.
Yeah, that's been the main blessing, being able to, like, you know, even getting a job in sports media, like a full time, like, you know, enough to live off is hard enough because it's so competitive, I guess. And then to do that in boxing, where it's so niche, you know, and I feel like there's probably very few, jobs that pay. Yeah, so I'm beyond chuffed that I can still carry on.
Were you ever close during the last couple months since April? Like, do you have a percentage of how likely you were that you had to move back to the UK?
I feel like I was always quite the immigration lawyer I hired that was based off, my wife's got a friend here who's a performer on the Strip, but she's English as well. And she recommended this attorney. So I had a chat with him and kind of, you know, went through the situation. It kind of felt like it was all going to be fine. But, you know, there was just that lingering thing in the back of your head where you don't really ever know. Like, but, you know, the things I was focusing on, you know, I've already been approved for this visa before. If anything, we're in a better spot now because I'd won more awards with the boxing writers. You know, so it's like you're kind of showing that you're maintaining the same level of quality, I guess, in what you do than you know, when I was before, when they approved a visa in 2021. And then when I was getting the paperwork through, like, from the lawyer, and a lot of it's like government issued, just standard, you know, US government forms, it all just seemed like quote unquote change in employment status. So yeah, I think the hard thing is coming to America, and once you're here, I think it's probably easier to stay. I think the hard thing is actually getting here in the first place and living, obviously, and working and having that visa approval.
Right.
But I recommend it to anyone who's thinking of doing it. I love living here. You can't put a price, I think, on waking up in the morning and the sun shining every day. Yeah. Like, I never want to get tired of that, you know. And also just the reliability of the weather. Like, in London in the summer, you could go out and, like, I'm wearing a T-shirt and shorts right now.
Right.
You could go out in London in a T-shirt and shorts in July, and you just won't know if you're going to get rained on or if things are just going to change and you're going to have, you regret not bringing out, a long-sleeved sweater or something.
Right.
Yeah, we don't have any of that here. Although I did recently just drive back from a fight week. We'll go into it later, what the fight week is about. But I drove through a monsoon. I had my first experience of driving through a monsoon. I had emergency alerts coming from, Nevada state, you know, government, whatever, saying you are literally in a monsoon.
Oh,
you know,
man.
like there's flash floods, you know, if you can pull over. But a lot of people were pulling over, but... And my car was like having that alert where it was like, you are aquaplaning, but I never felt not in control of the car. And I was only going like 10 miles an hour. I was driving across Lake Mead.
Oh,
and you could even see like on the top of some like cliffs, like new, like, you know, gushes of water coming down. But I was like, I couldn't ever see where the flash flood was. There was just like, you know, like a less than half an inch of water on the road, and it was always fine. So I just kept on driving.
Was that your first fight in, I mean, we'll touch on it in a second, but you covered the top-ranked car on ESPN in Glendale, Arizona. Was that your first in-person fight in Arizona?
Yeah, second time I've been in Arizona, but first fight. And yeah, I think it's a great state. It's, even though it's still a desert state, it's like way more green and lush than what Southern Nevada can be.
Right.
Or Joshua trees and things like that. I think, yeah, so like I felt like I was driving through Joshua tree, even though Joshua tree is in California, but I've driven through that before. And it's like Arizona's a bit like that. You know, you've got the classic cactus and things like that. They don't seem to grow here. And if you see one in Vegas, it's probably because it's been, you know, ripped out from somewhere else and brought here.
Yeah, I gotcha. So like, as I touched on this past Saturday, August 12th, from Glendale, Arizona on ESPN, Emmanuel Navarrete improves to 38-1 with 31 KOs as he gets the unanimous decision win over Oscar Valdez. And Navarrete got the scores of 116-112, 118-110, and 119-109. You know, obviously, for the listeners who saw it, it was a very entertaining fight. Valdez, I mean, two Mexican warriors, but Valdez always seems to be in these types of fights. He finds a way. He just always throws it all on the line. But you were in the building And then we talked about just before we came on air that sometimes, you know, when you watch a fight on TV and when you see it in person, you know, it could be a little different on how you score it. You know, there's obstructions and how you can see on TV, you have the angles, the aerial views and all that. But you being in the building, especially with the scores I just read, 116-112, 118-110, 119-109, all those three scores kind of give a different picture of what the fight was like. It's kind of, it's a little bit confusing. So you being in the building, what did you think? What do you think of those scores and what did you think of the fight?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I thought the fight was amazing. I'm so glad I went on that assignment and got to see it live because, you know, saw some good top rank prospects, saw some good, you know, I think there were six. Yeah, there were eight fights and the first six fights, you know, most on the prelims and then some of the fights in the main card, all knockouts, straight knockouts, like good, you know, performances coming in. Another difference, I think, as well, that the fans for this event, they were coming in early, you know. I think the total crowd numbers in the end were about 10,350, around that mark. And there was at least 5,000 people. It was already like half filled by, you know, like the third fight. And you rarely see that in boxing. Right. It was well attended. It was well supported. And it just had good energy. The co-main brought things down a little bit. They got booed, probably quite cruelly, but you know what you're going to do. And then in the main
boxing event,
but then in the main event, I mean, before the fight, I was thinking Oscar Valdez was going to come away successful. The things I was hearing during the week and speaking to Oscar himself, you know, there are just some people I think that just have it factor, and you know, for me, he has that. Or had it, you know, carries himself like a champion. I find him a really classy guy to be around. That's the second time I've been around him for a fight week. And, you know, but some things I was hearing was like the thing with Oscar is that he's been in so many wars and whether, you know, maybe it's one war already too many. But to be honest, I didn't feel it was. I thought he was going to get through to Navarrete. But yeah, as soon as the fight started, it was like really different than what I was expecting. Navarrete was, I gave him every single one of the first four rounds. Thought he was like awkward, tricky, really good at range. And it was like Valdez didn't really know what to do. But in my opinion, he made the adjustments in round five. Those are just kids coming in. He made those adjustments in round five by like closing the gap and knowing to fight in there. He's having more success, in my opinion. I gave him round five. I thought he landed the punch of the night in round six. By this point, I was starting to focus on my reports. I wasn't really scoring. But from round 7 to 12, in to like summary, I felt like Oscar Valdez did okay in the third quarter. And I probably gave him one or two more rounds then, but then it felt in the championship rounds he'd lost it. I think the difference between the two fighters is that Navarrete, with like how many he was just throwing, it was like Oscar Valdez would land one really good punch, but then Navarrete would throw like, you know, just like go guns like back at him, and it would be like, you know, 10, 5, 15 shots, or you know, and Valdez wouldn't be able to, you know, defend even half of them. I remember seeing maybe in round 8 or 9, it felt like Navarrete jabbed him maybe, you know, 12 times in a row, and Valdez maybe only blocked again half of them. But the thing that I always felt like it was always the sheer volume that was in Navarrete's favor. And even though he was causing it was like the accumulation of the punches were what was causing the eye to close, you know, and that kind of damage. But to me, you know, when it came to that round 7 to 10, it was such a crucial part in the fight. It just felt like Valdez had the shot that would put Navarrete down. I have seen people see it since online saying they thought Valdez never hurt him. I honestly thought he did. I definitely thought Valdez hurt Navarrete and definitely had his commanded his respect with those, you know, singular shots. But yeah, by the time that we saw Valdez backstage, he was pretty beat up, pretty bad. There was rumors that he'd broken the orbital bone, but yeah, apparently he didn't in the end. It was just bruising, and you know, thankfully it was bruising rather than anything more severe that would keep him out of the sport for even longer. But I really feel like 119-109 is an injustice for what I saw. I saw 116-112, maybe 115-113, but I feel like that's probably being a bit generous towards Valdez, but anything more for Navarrete than 116, I feel, is more generous to him. It kind of discounts how dangerous and threatening Valdez was at certain points in the fight, particularly rounds 5, 6, and I think around 9, where he just seemed to have that like singular punch that could have ended up ending things, but it ultimately never did. I really thought it's up there with some of the best, Mexican fights I've seen. Granted, those were on TV and not live, but I mean, I'd even see it again. I feel like out of all the great fights I've seen this year between Benavidez Plan, Davis Garcia, which had a rematch clause, Spence Crawford, which had a rematch clause, I feel like Valdez did way more than Spence, Ryan Garcia and Caleb Plan. But I think I wouldn't want to see the rematch next. I feel like, you know, I mean, Oscar told me in the week he was suffering from depression after he lost to Shakur Stevenson, and it took him, apparently he was saying, like weeks to kind of, you know, come around again. So I feel like he would need to, after this fight, kind of come back again and fight the kind of caliber of opponent he fought a couple of months ago, rebuild, and then see what happens, you know, with Navarrete. But yeah, they might have a rivalry going forward. In the arena, I honestly thought there were times when, he did enough to, or threaten, you know, threatening to do enough to warrant a rematch, particularly if he started the fight in the first round as he started in the fifth round, because it felt like he kind of just surrendered those first four rounds by not being able to adjust sooner to just how awkward and kind of unique Navarrete's style kind of is.
Right, absolutely. Did you see that quote from Valdez? I think it was during fight week where it was a fight. I think it was out here in Los Angeles. It might have been at the Dignity Health Sports Park, which is the former StubHub Center, Home Depot Center. It's been through a lot of names. But in Carson, California, where I think it was there where his jaw was broken in the fight. And he had said that during the fight, he thought, that his tooth came out or something, but he didn't think his jaw was broken. And then he kind of like during the round or the next round, he felt like, oh no, my teeth are there or something's like and he thought, I didn't think my jaw was broken. That even crossed my mind. I thought it was like my teeth or something. And then I felt, my teeth are still there. I can keep going. I thought that was such a crazy like quote like to say, because it's like his jaw was literally broken and he felt like, oh no, it was just like my teeth or something. And then once I saw like, I haven't lost anything. I can go back in there and keep going. I thought that was such a crazy thing for him to realize during that fight. But I mean, maybe it's the adrenaline of a fighter,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Mm. I think there's just some fighters that are just a little bit different. And I think he's one of them, being able to like, you know, take pain, fight through things. And I don't want to take anything away from other fighters who don't, I think it's perfectly fine in a fight to take a knee. And I think you even should, because, you can kind of surrender a 10-8 round if it's going to mean you can, quote unquote, waste enough time to get back into the fight rather than not taking the knee and getting drilled. So I think there's, you're perfectly fine doing that. Daniel Dubois did it a few times. But then obviously he didn't fight through, the injury hit that he had to, Joe Joyce.
Yeah.
But these are still like, fighters that go into the ring and have had good performances before and after that. You know, there's countless that have done things that, Daniel Dubois, did, but yeah, someone like Oscar Valdez, I just think it's a different kind of, mentality that is just so far removed from what a normal human being thinks and does. You saying about the teeth reminded me of a fighter in the UFC. I think it was Smith, where he was getting beaten so bad, he was actually getting his teeth, his teeth had fallen out, and he was picking them up from the canvas while he was still getting punched, and he was giving his teeth to the referee.
Right.
And it's like he was still, trying to get back into the fight, even though he's like handing three teeth to the ref to put in his pocket so that, might be able to put them back in with dentistry, however many days later from. But this is like, that would never occur to me to do. I'd be like, teeth's come out. No, get me out of here. F this. But yeah, other people are, in these sports, are wild men.
Yeah, rare breeds, right? Those fighters, they really are. And, you know, focusing on Navarrete, I don't think this is realistic, but I wanted to get your take on this. So obviously there's been some rumblings, and I think Navarrete, he was asked about it, and I think Shakur responded on Twitter, like, yeah, you know, kind of saying, like, come on, like he's not serious about it. Do you think that's any realistic possibility within the next maybe 6 to 9 months, Navarrete and Shakur? Or do you think Shakur is just, because he's at 135, this fight was at 130. I mean, should we hold out hope for that potential matchup or no?
I'm not sure I could see it in the next 6 to 9 months. I get the impression Top Rank, particularly maybe Bob Arum and probably even Shakur himself, feel like they kind of want to target, I think they want to clear out the lightweight division. And whoever's got the belts, I think they want to collect the belts, you know, Terence Crawford style, and then move up to 140. So it really depends on whether Navarrete is going to stay himself at 130 or move up and try and get a title himself. But if that was to happen, I think it would be different. But in that scenario, I can't see it happening in 6 to 9 months. I think it would be more, you know, a period after that, you know, and then, but, you know, if Navarrete got one of those belts and Shakur had another, that's a great in-house Top Rank, you know, champion versus champion fight they could make at 135, providing Navarrete wanted to do that in the first place. So yeah, I can't see it happening in the next 6 to 9 months, but, you know, I'm curious about that fight. I would like to see it myself. I think Navarrete won quite a lot of people over, you know, on a platform like that, you know, 10,000 people in the arena, ESPN, you know, big world title fight. And, you know, granted, I think out of his 12 last title fights, I think he's had, it's either 8 or 10 knockouts, but I think half of that run has been against kind of, you know, opposition that you might not think would be in a world title fight kind of caliber. So like, yeah, this is definitely a big fight and definitely a big win for him.
Do you think that maybe within the next 18 months, let's stretch the timeline a little bit, just because, you know, we know us being both in this game here, you know, the politics, the promoter politics, the network alignments and stuff, you know, it's real. It's there, unfortunately, for the fight fans, but it's there. And Shakur, you know, he's one of those guys at the moment who obviously he's very, very talented. So there's not a lot of people who really want to take a risk against him because he's so talented. But, you know, do you think, let me ask you like this, Al, do you think that, is a fight between Shakur and Navarrete more likely than if Shakur lands a big name at 135?
Like Lomachenko? Or a big name?
No, not even. I'm not even. Yeah, I think he could land Lomachenko, obviously. But I'm talking about the guys outside of the Top Rank ESPN bubble.
Yeah, like Gervonta Davis. And
correct.
And I hear you.
Even Ryan, yeah, I think Ryan.
I mean, right, like I feel like Ryan and Gervonta are kind of now kind of flirting with the 140 mark, and you know what's left at 135. You know, Frank Martin, I still feel like is, I feel like PBC thinks he's kind of one or two fights behind Isaac Cruz. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they would want the, you know, I don't think it would be in their interests to even maintain a fight with Shakur for Frank, whether it be Isaac Cruz. I feel like they're probably thinking we could get one more win for Isaac, and then that might warrant the Gervonta Davis rematch. I feel like they've got a lot going on their side. Ryan, I feel like he's, if I was Golden Boy, I feel like what they should do is get Ryan a, you know, comeback win, and to get him like looking good again, and, you know, remind everyone that he's this fast fisted guy who can put people down. I think he needs a performance like that. And then if he then has a, you know, good performance against a name at 140, all of a sudden a rematch with Gervonta, you know, it's like all roads lead to a rematch with Gervonta. I'm not trying to suggest that, but
yeah.
Considering, you know, that was 1.2 million pay-per-views in the US, and a gate that was like one of the top five, I think, in Las Vegas boxing history, you know, it makes sense financially to do it again, providing Ryan can be built back to get the momentum and warrant the fan interest. Between those names, I think Top Rank is going to be looking at, you know, their own sort of, you know, then you've got Devin Haney, Regis Prograis, all these kind of fighters are just a little bit too big, but, you know, out of the Top Rank ones, I feel like, you know, Lomachenko and, even T.O. is at 140 now, but I think it's definitely, a possibility, just not in 6 to 9 months. 18 months, I think, is a good timeline.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well. And then, you know, you touched on Haney. Obviously, he has the undisputed title at 135. How much longer do we see him, not only at the weight? I think it's, you know, you can, it's going to be quick, but how often, if you had to guess, would before he just vacates those titles and just completely moves up to 140?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like that's kind of already might be, maybe not the vacating the titles part, but it feels like, you know, he's kind of already making those moves now. So the fight with Progre would be at 140, you know, and those are quote unquote ongoing negotiations, you know, from someone I spoke to, from two people I spoke to today, like the deal's not done, but that's the talk. And Las Vegas would be the target city for that fight. And I really like that fight. And I think it's one. I saw Progre live for the first time in 2019, and I actually think he got a draw with Josh Taylor, even though I was, you know, British, and I thought that was a draw. I thought it was an amazing draw. But, you know, Taylor got the decision on the judges' scorecards that night. But just ever since, not sure Progre's really done that much. If Haney hadn't just kind of struggled to get a win against Lomachenko, I'd have easily picked Haney. So I feel like I really like that match to kind of see, you know, what both guys can offer. But yeah, I don't think Haney would, you know, maybe he would move back down to 135, but he is such a, it feels like he doesn't get, I don't think he gets the praise he deserves for doing what he's done in quite a short space of time. Like going over to Australia twice and bringing back the belts, you know, the first time going back and defending it.
You think it's more because like he doesn't, obviously to us, we, you know, we have a little bit more of an eye than the average fan, and you know he definitely has excellent boxing skills, but do you think because he's not like a KO artist he really hasn't garnered that attention?
Probably, which is why I think he should just fully lean into being a heel.
Like a Mayweather yeah, HBO 24/7 days.
Someone he's kind of modeled himself on anyway. I would just go full heel and maybe even turn on the fans.
It could work.
Yeah, you know, just like if you're not going to tune in to see him win and showcase his boxing skills, tune in to see him, you know, to see that he might, on the off chance, lose.
Right, absolutely.
But yeah, I think that might be a part of it. And maybe it's something that Shakur Stevenson might have to, you know, come to terms with. But, or not come to terms with, but, you know, figure out a way to get the kind of casual interest. But I feel like he will do that naturally anyway because of his, like, friendship and with Terence Crawford and with Crawford being a kind of mentor to him. Like, the kind of victory lap that Terence Crawford's doing right now, like, I don't think it was a knee-jerk reaction. I tweeted as soon as Crawford won. I said, like, that's one of the new faces. I think I even said that's the new face of American, you know, pay-per-view boxing. But it's not to do with what the numbers for the Spence fight generates. It's to, I think it, what's really going to be interesting, Crawford's now in the PBC family. Who he fights, you know, next. I've been told that Errol Spence won't really be activating that rematch clause until basically right at the last minute to see how he feel. You know, take that full 30 days that you get in the contracts before you can activate it to, you know, recover, you know, get over your injuries, spend time with your family, figure out what, you know, kind of you want and your team and whatever. But yeah, so regardless of whether, you know, Terence is going to fight him or maybe fights Jamel once Jamel's kind of had his fight with Canelo, you know, there's just options for Terence, and it seems like quite a few of them are pretty big. So I'm really curious what his numbers are going to be after that, because we know his pay-per-view numbers weren't really impressive before Spence. So it really feels like that was such a lot for whoever won, doesn't matter if it's Spence or Crawford, such a launch pad to push them into a realm that they'd never been in before in terms of like box office draw ability. And just, you know, having Shakur next to him, I feel like some of that shine might come on Shakur Stevenson as well, just because it's like, okay, so Crawford's the best male American boxer in America right now, if not the world. Shakur's probably the future number one male boxer in America, if not the world. And it's like you've got them right now. So I feel like there's probably quite an easy way they can market themselves together. And Shakur, I think his popularity will grow naturally anyway, you know, because he's coming into the ring and he's going to beat, you know, whoever, and maybe he gets the Lomachenko fight and, you know, and beats him maybe even better than Devin Haney did, because that was a bit of a controversial result. I think looking back, I think I might have had Lomachenko just nicking it. And I'm sure I only heard two reporters that felt like Devin won, Mike Coppinger was one, and one of the Fight Height guys was another, Ron Goodall. They had Devin winning. So yeah, if Shakur can look good against Lomachenko, and well, you know, still cultivate the sort of, you know, being on camera with Crawford, I feel like he won't have the issue that Devin has in terms of, you know, people decide, you know, being unsure whether they even want to tune in to see him fight. I feel like anyone who's watching this is on the edge should be, you know, these are the stars of American boxing.
Do we know, you touched on out of the rematch clause between Spence and Crawford, that there's a 30-day window, and you think Spence, you've been told, or what you've been hearing, Spence might activate it right at the last minute. If it's not activated, or if it is activated, but they, you know, there was reports that by December, I think even Crawford said it, that the rematch has to happen by December or something like that. Does PBC have any options in addition to the rematch clause with Spence on Crawford, if that Spence rematch doesn't happen right away?
Do you mean Crawford? Like, if the Spence rematch doesn't happen, does PBC have an option with Crawford?
Is correct.
That, yeah, they do. Yeah, he's part of the PBC family now, as far as I'm aware, or as what I've been told. Yeah. Plus, they've got the fights for him though as well. It makes sense him kind of doing a PBC swing now. And like the money that he would have been seeing now as the pay per views got tabulated. You know, and his, you know, the back end check for him is being cut. It really makes sense to feel like, you know, they can put on, they can not only provide the opponent, but they can put on, and, you know, quote unquote, an event that would draw in the eyes and the figures. So yeah, even if you're looking out, if the Spence Jr. rematch doesn't happen, and Jamel, you know, fights Canelo, whatever the result there is, and that might take a, you know, time for, you know, Crawford to eventually fight Jamel. I'm not even sure Jamel will come back down to 154. But, you know, let's just remove those two possibilities. There's still, like, you know, Tim Zhu and, you know, there's loads of 154 guys. Trying to think of a few, but I don't want to, like, you know, Tony Harrison, Lubin, Ramos. I feel like PBC's got an embarrassment of riches at 154, and it just depends. You've got those four that I just mentioned don't have the name or brand value that, I guess, Jamel or... particularly a Jamel after a Canelo fight, or Spence, you know, the brand value that they would bring to the A or B side, or whatever, however it would be. Crawford for me should be the A side now. You know, you probably need to have like some sort of round robin where someone looks great, or whoever just has a great fight. You know, like Fundora looked like he could be the man a few, you know, even 9 months ago. Things can change in boxing quite quickly, and perception can change. But yeah, I feel like out of all of the promoters, the opponents for Crawford now are in the PBC roster. And as far as I'm aware, and what I've been told, they do. He is in their roster now. Like, he's a part of it.
And then also this past Saturday, August 12th, from the O2 Arena, Anthony Joshua returns with a knockout over Robert Hellenius, who takes the fifth professional loss of his career. This was a seventh round KO. So Hellenius, you know, if people kept up with the drama during this fight and event, Hellenius was a late substitution as the opponent because Dillian White, who was the original opponent, for this event against Anthony Joshua, failed a drug test. So before we get your take on AJ's KO victory over Hellenius, Al, I want to get your reaction on White's failed drug test and obviously his removal from the event. You know, give us your reaction on that, because we know that he's had some run-ins in the past with situations like that. So what's your take on this?
Yeah, I will caveat what I'm about to say by saying I've got a relatively blasé attitude to policing drugs and performance enhancing drugs. I think it's such a hard, I think it's just a losing battle, whether it's a war on drugs for recreational use or a war on drugs in sport. But, and there's also like so many substances on the banned list. But if you're it's so easy for me, if I was thinking, or anyone, you know what you're doing and eating, and you have to be really, I don't know what would be the right word, but you just have to not be paying attention to fail a drug test. But to do it repeatedly, you know, from, you know, once in 2009, second time, I think it was 2019 against Oscar Rivas. and now this time, I mean, it's, I just think it paints a very, very poor picture of Dillian White's. If he's just going to say he unknowingly did it, then, you know, pay attention. You know, this has happened like twice in your career before. It feels like, anyway, he's kind of on the tail end of his career, but this, whether this could be the end of him, I really don't know. Like, I think in any other sport it would be, but it's boxing, and I don't particularly feel like the outrage has been worse than what it was with Jarrell Miller, for instance. But Jarrell Miller's like cocktail of you know, performance enhancing drugs he was taking, it was so clear that they, like, you wouldn't be able to unknowingly do the things that were, I believe that were on his the things that Jarrell Miller had taken. But he's been fighting since, you know, and even after he was banned for the, or tested positive for the Anthony Joshua fight, when Andy Ruiz came in at last minute and beat Joshua in what was seen as like a shock, massive shock for, you know, on the British side. I don't know if it was a shock from like American observers, but
it definitely was.
Yeah, what a shock. Yeah. I suppose that, okay, I remember, I think it was 40-1 he was the you know.
Yeah. I know some people who just, they always put money on the underdog in Vegas, and they won big on Ruiz. So I even probably paid their mortgage for the whole year.
Oh my God, I need to do that. I need to get in on that.
I
spoke to Eddie Hearn later that year, like for an interview for loads of things, but one of them was like, you know, this like, you know, drugs drama. And I said, you know, I can remember saying like, you know, sometimes in boxing, it seems like scandal can make things bigger, like in a way that doesn't mean it's negative. Like how big, like is Jarrell Miller against Anthony Joshua in New York, where Joshua just lost, is that a big fight? And, you know, Hearn said that, you know, that's an effing massive fight. So it feels like even though, you know, and the outrage for Miller was so much more intense than any other outrage and like drugs tests I think we've even seen in boxing over the years since then. So, you know, maybe White comes again. But for me, I think it's, you know, it felt like he was on the tail end of his career anyway. He's just done this. It's the third time it's happened to him. It's I don't know. It's all different situations. Like with Conor Benn as well, it's like how much goodwill can you just erase, you know, and turn people off just with like your whole attitude to the board, to fans, you know, the way that you're tweeting and things like this. But I do know, like internally, that like there's you know, with Benn's camp, with Matchroom, with DAZN, they really, really think that, you know, what, that he was innocent. And it just feels like with Dillian White, the organizations were kind of moving away. Like, I don't think Dillian White is not part of the Matchroom roster, but it feels like there was a lot of distance being taken with Dillian, and there wasn't that distance being taken with Conor Benn. You know, it feels like, you know, he is still part of the Matchroom DAZN family and they're supporting him and things like this. And I don't think Dillian White's really being supported. So, you know, maybe that can be telling in and of itself as well.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a good point to make, that if you compare the Conor Benn situation with this Dillian White situation, there is definitely a contrast in between both. I don't know. Maybe Matchroom really believes that Conor Benn's innocent. And
I honestly think they do. Yeah.
Yeah.
But from what I've spoken to, like, you know, people at, you know, Matchroom and DAZN, yeah, I feel they, it does feel like they're really do think that he's innocent and you know, believe him and want to support him in that. But yeah, there was Amir Khan as well. Has got like a retro active ban, so can't help but feel like, you know, what the hell is going on in British boxing?
Right. Yeah, it's all popping up over there. Pun intended, I guess. But you know, going back to the actual fight, obviously Helenius was a late substitution here, and got knocked out in the seventh round. This was actually AJ's first KO stoppage since December 2020. So it's been a couple of years. That's when he knocked out Kubrat Pulev in December 2020. So what'd you think about the performance? Did you give Helenius even a slight? I mean, obviously you always have a puncher's chance in a fight, but realistically, did you give him any type of realistic chance when he became the late substitution?
No. And it's not like disrespect to Helenius. Like I remember him fighting, you know, he's been around for more than a decade in the European scene. But his time at the, you know, the plays in the rankings where Joshua should be competing against, his time there is, you know, beyond gone. And considering what Deontay Wilder, you know, how easily he handled Helenius, I was kind of I also feel like you've just got to put on a certain performance to remind people, or you know, if to remind people who you are. I feel like Canelo needed to knock out Golovkin to remind people and reestablish momentum that he had prior. You know, losing to Bivol, I feel like he was expected to beat Bivol, and then he just struggled with him, and like Bivol's fainting and his like tripling of the jab, and you know, Canelo just didn't know what to do with him at all. And even, you know, whether that was like, you know, he wasn't getting the best advice from Eddie Hearn also in the corner during the fight, but neither of them knew what to do, you know, to thwart what Bivol was doing. And I feel like he really needed a bigger performance against Golovkin, and he didn't show it. So then all of a sudden, you know, the narrative could be, you know, is Canelo slipping? And again, like John Ryder, perfect opponent to kind of like build a really big, you know, performance against. But with Joshua, I feel like, you know, after going two fights against Usyk, who granted is probably, you know, the best cruiserweight of all time, you know, one of the pound for pound top fighters. If Usyk goes and beats Fury, he suddenly becomes the pound for pound number one. You know, really talented, extraordinarily talented guy with all that Olympic background as well. That's being able to offset his, you know, lack of height. He's like 6'3", 6'4" probably. But against this like new generation of super heavyweights, he's the little guy. Joshua did better in the second fight, but he needed a big performance to, you know, to reestablish, you know, that he is in this mix of, you know, Fury, Usyk. I think Wilder is still in the mix just because of how powerful he is. But, you know, the first few rounds, it's just, I feel like I would have wanted to have seen the knockout in the by the third round, of all things considered. But I still think there's the element of, you know, the withdrawal happened so late. Like, I don't think even organisers knew until the Saturday. So that's 7 weeks before the fight. There's a scrambling to bring in an opponent to save the whole show so that fighters on the undercard can get paid. You know, Joshua's kind of signing off on, you know, he's been preparing to fight someone else, and now he's, you know, things like that can, you know, make you, you know, if everyone had a full camp, would he have knocked out Helenius faster? I think probably. But I feel like with Joshua, it's just his, I don't think he knows, it's not like a take to say this, it's been said before, I don't think he knows who he is as a fighter. He's going from like trainer to trainer to trainer. And you know, they're like whatever style he's kind of adapted, and since like Klitschko and Ruiz, I wouldn't say ruined him, but ruined the version that was, you know, before when he fought Dillian White for the first time, and was being billed as this like Olympic killer and, you know, the kind of golden boy of not just British boxing but British sport. I remember speaking to Sky Sports, and they were really, really adamant that this guy was going to be like a Roger Federer for boxing, you know, like clean cut, good looking, and, you know, could carry not just the British flag but like the whole of boxing on his shoulders. And then obviously gets upset by Ruiz and kind of that changes. But yeah, I just feel like he's not who he was anymore, and he doesn't know who he is, and he's way too tentative. And those two fights, Klitschko and Ruiz, are just, I think it made him very aware of his, you know, lack of punch resistance compared to other heavyweights. And I think the thing with like Tyson Fury, he's been on the floor, but he recuperates pretty quickly. You know, there's some fighters just handle being hit differently, and I don't think Joshua handles it very well from what we've seen.
Do we see Wilder in the next 6 to 9 months?
I really think so. Yeah, I really think so. It's from what I was hearing last week. Skill Challenge, which is, you know, the promotional company in Saudi Arabia, they had representatives in London throughout the fight week, and that there would be, you know, getting ready to prepare a bid, you know, to host it. And I feel like the bid would have to be pretty big for it to not even be on the radar, really, in American boxing. Because over, if you were going to put it in Vegas, I think you could easily have a $15 to $20 million gate, if not more, And I think you could easily sell 500 to 800,000 pay-per-views. So you could, you're definitely looking at like an 80, I'm doing very quick math, I think it's like $80 million, let's say, or 100 in total between the revenue for pay-per-view and the gate. So I feel, you know, if Saudi Arabia's going to, you know, Skill Challenge is going to be able to, you know, front a guarantee for both fighters for $50 million each, then it just makes sense to that. I think that's the reason why we're not really hearing it, you know, that there might be a tug of war between, you know, well, we might want to host it in Vegas or New York or somewhere like that. It just feels like it's a very Saudi Arabia fight for January. I feel like they've probably by now, if, you know, if they haven't wrapped up the Joshua side by now, they probably will in the next couple of days. And then it comes down to the Deontay Wilder part. I've heard over here that Showtime Sports would be, you know, really, really interested in broadcasting it. But as far as I'm aware, I think the thing with when Saudi Arabia, I keep saying Saudi Arabia, it kind of annoys me when people in boxing say the Saudis. It's like, you know, be specific about who's actually hosting it, like Prince Khalid and Skill Challenge Promotions. But when they host a fight, they want to control everything, and then they kind of auction off various parts of it. So like whether Showtime would win that auction, to, you know, it's not like they would be guaranteed to broadcast the fight. But to me it makes sense, because they've got all the reel of, you know, having worked with Deontay Wilder, and they've even aired a Anthony Joshua fight before, maybe even two, before he joined DAZN, when they worked with Sky Sports, I guess, and Matchroom. But yeah, so they've got relationships with both fighters. It would make sense that they were the broadcast partner over here. But I feel like, to cut a long story short, the Anthony Joshua side, I think, is kind of like almost a foregone conclusion. It's just then speaking to Deontay and then wrapping his side up. But yeah, I feel like that is, we've had such a good run of super fights, like in 1 year, Javonte Davis, Ryan Garcia, Spence Crawford, you know, Canelo is going to be a good one, you know, no matter who he kind of fights, as long as he's fighting. I mean, that's an undisputed champion against an undisputed champion. You know, that should be celebrated, even though they're kind of, two weight classes apart. But this to me always felt like the next super fight. And I feel like the time's just right, because if Anthony Joshua fights, no disrespect to Anthony Joshua, but if he fights anyone in the top 5-6, I feel like he's a knockout threat. And then all of a sudden, this payday goes away. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe the Tyson Fury payday goes away. It's like you want to get the payday now. I would pick Wilder. He's not gun shy, and I feel like Joshua kind of is a little bit gun shy, or a lot gun shy. And Wilder has been down, and he gets up, and he just wants to carry on fighting. And I think if Joshua goes down, there's something in him that says, "I'm good." I'd love to see it, but I just feel like Wilder wins. But I would definitely love to see it. I feel like it takes a little bit of sheen when it's in Saudi Arabia, though. I will also say that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, we would love it for it to happen in obviously Vegas, New York, LA,
London. You know, there's so many better places to host it. You know, we've got an American and a British fighter. If it was in Vegas, I'm not sure. There was a time where I think it would be like Mayweather, Ricky Hatton, you know, with like the sheer number of traveling British fans, and the whole how hot that fight felt. Thank you.
Kids walking in on Al Dawson here on the Last Round Podcast,
though. Showing me his Spideys. So there was a time where I feel like it could have been like a modern version of Mayweather and Hatton, just in terms of how feverish it would felt for the fans involved. But I feel like the British fans would still travel to Joshua. It's just he's gone from being a stadium fighter consistently and being able to outsell even the England national soccer team. Right.
He misses dad. He's like, "Hey, when are you going to come out?"
Is it come from a stadium fighter, you know, selling out 90,000 tickets, back down to an arena fighter? I just hope, you know, if it was going to be in Vegas or anywhere, I just would hope they was going to travel. But all of that's mute. It's going to be happening in Saudi Arabia in January.
Right. And then we touched on Undisputed. So this week is a kickoff press conference for Canelo Charlo, first first leg is in New York and the secondary leg is in LA. So, you know, by the time people are listening to this, I think, you know, a couple, some of them might've happened in New York, might've happened or something, but, you know, just give me your take. What do you think is going to happen at the presser? I mean, cause we know the Charlo brothers, they love to talk and sometimes they're involved in some crazy stuff. Let me ask you like this, Al, do we see any type of, you know, retroactive, I guess, view of the plant situation that happened in Beverly Hills during the Canelo plant kickoff press tour?
Oh yeah. Jermell, it depends, like nothing would surprise me with the Charlos, but they do definitely bring like a angry kind of energy to wherever they are. And even in when Crawford had just knocked down Spence, and then he was hanging over the rope and saying you're next, and you know Jermell didn't have any chill even then, and you know he's saying, you know, saying that no, you know, he's you know got his own stuff to go on, but he was like, I can't remember what the exact quote was, but he was mouthing off back to Terrence. And then on the All Access epilogue, James Harden, the basketball player, was saying, oh, you know, we're going to have that fight. And Jermell was like, even just having angry energy to him going, I've got my own stuff going on, undisputed. Then, of course, there was a bit of a spill out with his brother Jamal getting slapped by Caleb Plant. And that was inside one of the hallways. And then there was like the commotion spilled out into the parking lot. And I think the partners of the Charlos were kind of getting into it as well. So Jermell could be quiet and kind of law. I don't know. Nothing would surprise me, but it would also, I think it would be better if he was saying something to Canelo, because Canelo's now at the point where he would respond, and he'd respond in English.
Yeah.
It's like he did with, like, you know, payday and get the F out of here, man. And, you know, like his, you know, personality's coming through a lot more, you know, in, you know, English speaking, you know, obviously the personality was already there in Spanish and stuff, but I just feel, yeah, I feel like his level of fame kind of grew another notch when, you know, people that didn't know Spanish could suddenly like understand, like get a sense of, you know, how he was handling trash talk and things. So I'd love to see Jermell bring that kind of energy at one of these press dates, whether it's in New York or Los Angeles, and just find out how, you know, Saul will react.
Right. Yeah, I think that whole situation, you know, the Charlo brothers, they're so polarized. They're very polarizing, both of them, for the sport. But you know, they go through these peaks and valleys in their own personal lives, and then sort of reportedly they're both not getting along with each other, even though they're brothers. It's a crazy situation, but they're very polarizing to watch from the outside as athletes. And then, you know, obviously Jermall was supposed to initially get the fight reportedly with Canelo, and then for some reason or another he couldn't, and then his brother stepped in. It's like, man, like what a turn of events that is. But yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that. And like you said, you touched on it, Canelo, especially since he's left Golden Boy, after that separation, he has been a little bit more vocal in interviews and in press conferences, and you know, speaking English and stuff. So giving us those quotes like he did after the Billy Joe Saunders fight against Demetrius Andrade and all that, you know, he throws his sound bites out there. So you know, I could see something happening. I mean, I don't know, who knows. I didn't think him and Plant were gonna go at it. I didn't think Plant was gonna swing at him, and then yeah, Canelo was gonna, I didn't think that was gonna happen, and that happened
with a cut on his face, didn't he, in return?
Right. So I mean, we'll see, because you know, the Charlo brothers especially. And do you think Jermall will be in attendance?
I wouldn't be surprised. Like, I think Eddie Udonoso also even said Jermall was next.
Right.
So from what I've heard, that is probably, you know, that's not out of the question. You know, for Jermall to get the first fight on the Canelo's 3-fight PBC deal and Jermall to be the second. So depends how the Charlo brothers want to handle, you know, that kind of situation. But, you know, if you're going to have two of them kind of drawing off of them for the intimidate, you know, trying to have the intimidation factor or just try and lure him into a false sense of security or something. But Canelo's been in so many fights that it's like, right. You know, whatever you're going to do is going to have hardly any effect on him.
Absolutely. And then one final thing that I wanted to get your take on, Al, before we finish up here on the last round. Obviously, we're very appreciative every time you come on the show here. So the UFC is currently in an antitrust case. I've had some boxing fans kind of ask me about it. And you obviously cover MMA as well. You know, and the overview of the case is kind of like, you know, the monopoly. UFC is kind of like a monopoly and, you know, and all that. Can you kind of give us an update on what's going on with that? I mean, do we think that UFC in the coming years will kind of have the boxing model that boxing has with these separate promoters and these network alliances? What do you think? What's your take on it?
It's so hard to kind of forecast the future, but the guys that have been reporting on it really well, John Nash at Bloody Elbow, one of them, they, from what I saw, they did seem to think that it was going to be a massive shakeup in the UFC. But for background, for anyone who, like boxing fans who might not know, the judge was basically ruling on like how UFC used various, or is alleged to use various maneuvers that ensured that, you know, one, that they would be buying up, you know, rival promotions, and two, keep fighter pay low and just manipulate certain things to ensure that they became or are what was being called a monopsony. So it's like they're the only buyer in the market. Because if you're not in the UFC, you know, I mean, if things are changing maybe a little bit, but the change is so slow because UFC just controls, like, not controls, but they're so powerful in the sport of MMA. It would be like PBC and Top Rank and Golden Boy and Ludabella and Dimitri Salita and Tom Loeffler all being one company, and all those fighters are at one company and kind of freezing out, I guess, British boxing, which is kind of freezing out anyway, in my opinion. British boxing is like in a bit of a weird state at the moment. It would be like that kind of situation where, like, you know, you do get, you know, Bellator have kind of been around. They've got some decent fighters, but they just don't have the, you know, kind of pulling power or the brand name and recognition that the UFC has. But whether, I mean, this antitrust thing has been going on since, I think, like, it's been going on years, like since right. At least like maybe 2016. And it's been led by former fighters. So I think the way that this new thing is working is that all fighters on the roster, I think a default position is that they would also be suing. So that the payout could be quite significant for, you know, fighters who, you know, would have been effectively underpaid. The argument is even someone like Conor McGregor could have been underpaid because, you know, suddenly he's coming into boxing and fighting Floyd Mayweather or whatever and earning exorbitant amounts more than what he ever did, you know, in his whole UFC career combined. And the same thing is happening in Francis Ngannou. Same thing, I think, even happened with Jake Paul. I think Nate Diaz earned more for the Jake Paul fight than he did in his entire UFC career. And that guy's been in the UFC for more than a decade.
That's insane.
Yeah, and, you know, suddenly he, as soon as he fought Conor McGregor for the first time and beat him, his he was always seen as a cult hero, but his fame suddenly exploded even more so after that. And even after that, yeah, his accumulated paychecks was still apparently lower than what he got just for going into a boxing ring and losing to Jake Paul. So I think the default position is that all the fighters on the roster now are like in the pool to sue, and they have to opt out. So that will be a really interesting scenario. Who actually stays in? Because you would think that there's probably a message going around with the UFC to get people to opt out, or say it's like in their best interest to opt out, or, you know, various. I don't know how they would work it, but yeah, there's definitely it's definitely going to be like, if you're in the, you know, let's say me and you are, and we'll welcome Mike back onto the podcast
eventually. Know, eventually,
yeah, eventually, yeah. 5 or 10 years, we'll get him back on, and we'll look back at this moment, and from the people that have been covering it really well, like John Nash, feel like they've been saying it's good. It will be seen as a landmark period in MMA, in UFC, but also MMA history.
Right. Yeah. No, it's definitely intriguing to watch it unfold, especially with the the merger with WWE and Endeavor. Obviously they're becoming, I think the official name that they have that I've seen on SEC documents in the United States is like New Whale Inc. Or it's one of them, it's called New Whale Incorporated or something. I don't know. It's probably like a play on words, like, oh, it's a big, we're a big whale company or something. But I think, you know, for them, obviously it's a great business decision in terms of, you know, profitability, but it's only going to bring more eyeballs and more scrutiny to them because they're becoming bigger and bigger and bigger with that acquisition, right?
The other thing that I was like, it seems like boxing is the odd one out now, you know, like if WWE and the UFC are, you know, that this parent company owns both. Like we even said it on this podcast, I think it was just before, it was probably around September, October, might have even been November last year. It might have even been on the Christmas show where we did the quiz. Right. Which yeah. I will want to come back on this year.
Just yeah. Oh, no, he's already prepared for that, trust me. Yeah.
But yeah, I'm sure, like, we're talking about WWE. She was, you know, the then co-CEO, I think she was at the time, Stephanie McMahon. She even had this line in a, I can't remember if it was like a shareholder meeting or it was an environment like that that had just, you know, come up in, you know, a wrestling blog, and then I saw it and wrote a story around it. But yeah, she was saying that, you know, WWE had been interested in, boxing and putting together boxing events. It was very vague, but they had a clear interest in boxing, you know, so there was like, you know, you could even, you know, think how that would work because, you know, they would have to either recruit like an Olympian who's just turned pro and, you know, build a star up, or you just come in and buy Golden Boy or buy 360 Promotions or DiBella Inc. or Top Rank or PBC. You could buy any, who would make sense, you know, considering it, the WWE and the UFC involved, who's really of that stature? It'd be either PBC or Top Rank, really. It does make me think like,
Dana White has said for the last couple of years, especially since the Conor McGregor Mayweather event, that he's, you know, oh, I have plans to go into boxing. And then he would say, oh no, it's on the back burner. And then he's like, oh yeah, I'm still looking into it. So like, it's still kind of in the back of his mind, you know, maybe now that, Endeavor kind of owns WWE and UFC, they're all kind of essentially under one umbrella, you know, maybe they'll talk to Dana White and WWE and then they're like, hey, let's explore this to see how viable this is.
If they try and relaunch or, you know, resurface like Surfer Inc., I don't think that's the really way to do it. Like Dana says some things where it's like, you know, let's get involved in boxing, and then he kind of criticizes boxing and he calls every event a going out of sale situation, and I'm sure he'd probably criticize boxing this year, but I just don't see how you can with the year boxing has had. And really it's been led by PBC. So if you're going to try and buy anyone, just have to try and bid big for probably PBC, but really you will probably want to buy both PBC and Top Rank, you know, and kind of merge them somehow. Right. But again, this is like, yeah, you know, fantasy football or something.
Right. Yeah.
It's probably a lot harder to do in practice.
I mean, with UFC having the ESPN relationship and Top Rank already being in the ESPN family, I think that would be a natural conversation starter for them. Like, oh, well, they're already here. Like, why don't we just look at them? You know? So yeah. I could see that. Yeah. But you, like you said, it's like fantasy football right here, speculation and all that, you know, it's fun to go down these pathways here. But Al, obviously we, like I said, I keep repeating it, but it never gets old. We obviously appreciate every time you come in here on the Last Round Podcast. The next time you come on here, Mike might be here eventually.
Yeah, might allow him back.
Yeah.
I quite like sitting in his chair, though.
So, yeah, I'll make sure he's the first listener to this entire episode. But, you know, like we touched on at the beginning, you're now with new outlets after leaving the Insider after seven years, but you're now relocated here in the West Coast of the United States. And before we completely sign off here, go ahead and let the listeners know for the first time ever here, at least on the Last Round Podcast, where they can find you and follow you as of today.
Yeah, but I appreciate always, you know, coming on. I'll always come on with you guys. yeah, you do, you know, great stuff, and you're really nice to be around, both you and Mike. You can find me, like, my social media handle is always Alan Dawson Sport, A-L-A-N-D-A-W-S-O-N Sport, mainly on Twitter, but I'll still probably be on Twitter. But yeah, now I'm the news editor at Pro Box TV, boxing and MMA videographer at Fight Hype. I've got a weekly combat sports column at the Sporting Tribune, and feature writer at PBC.
Yeah, you're definitely busy, huh? You still probably got more stuff down the pipeline coming down, right?
Yeah. A couple of things potentially coming up that should, you know, get a bit more work. But really, I like the idea of just being on a retainer, you know, so you know where you are every month. But if and when these other projects come in, I'll take a look at them. But yeah, there's definitely some good stuff, hopefully, to come as well.
Awesome. So for once again, on behalf of my normal co-host, Michael Shepherd, who's not here this week, he'll be back soon, hopefully. Eventually. I'll use the word eventually. And for my late substitution in Alan Dawson of Fight Hype, the Sporting Tribune, PBC, and many others to come, possibly in the future. And for me, Danny Z, this is the last round.
Thanks for supporting and listening to the show. Follow us at The Last Round 12 on social media. Rate, review, and subscribe. This is The Last Round Podcast.